This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, therapy, overdose, and veiled threat. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode number 50. 50? Holy cow. Episode number 50 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. This week, I'd like to thank Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from deborahdunbar.com, CC Jameson from ccjameson.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of vickytharp.com, Dharma Kelleher of dharmakelleher.com, Chris Ann, Jimmy Coe of crimmybox.com, and Larry Darter for their support. I'd also like to thank my newest Coffee Club patrons, Ann Bell Feinstein, Zara Alter, and Terry Thomas, along with all of my longtime Coffee Club patrons for their support month after month. You can find links to all the writers supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/50. And to learn more about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon. P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Fifty episodes. Man, where has the time gone? These last 50 episodes have flown by. And honestly, they have been a blast. So thank you so much for listening to the show and sending in your questions week after week. And speaking of sending in questions, I think some of you are reluctant to send in questions. You don't have to listen to the entire backlist of episodes. I mean, I encourage you to do so, but you don't have to in order to send in a question. If it's been asked before, I may cover it again, or I may send you a thank you note with a link to where it's already been answered. Either way, you will get an answer. It may take some time, but I will get you that answer eventually. Even if it's a question I've answered before, it may allow me a chance to go on a tangent to cover a topic that we haven't talked about before. And more importantly, it isn't a stupid question. There are no stupid questions. Okay, actually, that's a lie. There are stupid questions, but they usually come from stupid people, and stupid people are not my audience. You, the smart, well-read, slightly off-kilter lovers of mystery, suspense, and the occasional serial killer investigation, you, my friend, are why I do this podcast week after week. So put your double-brimmed Sherlock hat on and send me a question right now. You can go to writersdetective.com/podcast. Okay, well, I really wanted to do something big for this 50th episode, but being the time-crunched, part-time procrastinator that I am, I ended up working two 18-hour days yesterday and today, or I guess by the time I get this podcast published, it will be yesterday and the day before. I promise one of these days I will start batch recording these episodes. Anyway, yesterday and today were mainly spent driving from one end of the state to the other and back. And on the drive, I started listening to the audiobook, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, by Lori Gottlieb. Without giving you any spoilers, it's about a therapist going to therapy. Not only is it like laugh out loud funny in many parts, it's really, it's very poignant, I guess would be the way to put it. It is not a self-help book. It's more of a memoir, but we get to learn from her through the process. And the people she describes in this book, who I assume are amalgamations of real people with names changed to protect the guilty, and their peculiar personality traits. You can't make up the things that are described. I mean, sometimes truth is more amazing than fiction. But some of the personality traits that she describes are so spot on that they may spark some ideas for you for crafting realistic characters of your own. And I was also struck by the similarities between psychoanalytic therapy sessions and then the law enforcement interviews that I do. They are, of course, very different conversations with very different purposes, but I've always been fascinated by dyadic communication, the two-person communication, and the way that it plays out, I guess. And it's just interesting to hear something I'm very familiar with as far as this communication mode, but done in the therapy session, and the, I guess, what I could learn from it, applying it to law enforcement interviews. And lastly, there are some really helpful nuggets in the book that may help us each get out of our own way, or at least see some of the patterns in ourselves that we might not realize that we're ignoring. So anyway, it's a great book, and if it sounds remotely interesting to you, I highly recommend it, and I hope you'll check it out. I will add a link to it in the show notes at writersdetective.com/50. And again, the name of that book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb. Jesse Norrie writes, I've got a character who dies of an overdose. Soon after, someone finds her face down in bed, thinks she's asleep, and stabs her in the back. How much time would go by before cause of death could be determined? Would the new crime be attempted murder or desecration of a corpse? And would a homicide division hand off the case to a different team? Thank you. Thanks for the question, Jesse. I get quite a few questions about suicide, actually, but this is a unique twist. Determining the actual cause of death, meaning the overdose, would take however long it takes for the lab to conduct a toxicology exam, which could be a matter of hours, days, or even a week, depending on the kind of access the agency has to a crime lab. Now, obviously, if the agency has their own lab, they could get the results, you know, rather quickly. But for this part of your story, we can call it author's choice, however it works best in your story. Now, that said, it's important to know that they would pretty quickly determine that the stab wound was postmortem. So even if it takes a while to determine the cause of death was an overdose, they could rule out the stabbing pretty quickly, I would assume. Now, of course, this will lead to more questions than answers, like who stabbed her, why did they stab her, was the stabbing suspect present when she died, meaning during the overdose, or how did the stabber get access to her place, was there any sign of forced entry, and so on. One of the first things a new patrol cop learns about on their first few dead body calls after they get out of the police academy is the concept of post-mortem lividity, or PML. When a person dies, their heart stops pumping blood, obviously, and the pressure of the blood in their system drops off. And that causes the blood to stop moving through the circulatory system. And when this happens, gravity takes over. And the blood settles in whatever part of the body is at the lowest point or down. So, and just real quick, PML is also called hypostasis or liver mortis. And that's liver is L-I-V-O-R in this case. So with Jesse's decedent being face down in bed, the blood would pool throughout the anterior side of the decedent's body, anterior being the front. And forget about the stabbing for a minute. This means that when the police arrive, they will see a definitive color change between the front and back of the decedent. Her back will be pale, and her front will be a reddish, purplish hue from the blood settling in her system. And this happens pretty quickly. But after about 6 hours, PML will become fixed. So that means if you move the body, the blood will stay in the same place, like it will stay on the anterior or front side even after you've rolled her over onto her back after that 6 hour point, roughly 6 hours. But if the decedent is moved before that 6 hours, you may see indications of the PML shifting. Now, this is one of the key things that first officers arriving on the scene will look for on a decedent, any indication of whether the body has been moved. And whether that indicates foul play or an attempt at rendering some sort of first aid, obviously that's going to depend on what the investigation reveals. But it is a question that the police will definitely seek an answer to. And somebody that was already dead, stabbing someone that was already dead, will definitely produce a different result than someone that's living, both in the injury itself and how the blood presents within the crime scene. The lack of blood pressure, even the lack of blood on that side of the body, will yield different results than if you were to stab a living person. Kind of like the difference between popping a water balloon and popping a Ziploc bag that has water in it. Okay, our blood pressure isn't nearly as high, or shouldn't be as high as a water balloon, but I hope that illustrates the point a little bit. And the crime the person is prosecuted for would really depend upon a few things. First, what the detectives can prove. And second, what the prosecutor is willing to charge the suspect with. There may be elements to the crime that they either can or can't prove that will be a deciding factor in which crime to charge the suspect with. If it was my case, I would work it as an attempted murder, or even as an actual murder, like considering it a murder, at least until that toxicology screen comes back and tells me otherwise. And even then, we, the investigators of the case, may still be looking at the tox screen or toxicology screen as possibly part of that foul play aspect until we know otherwise. And then lastly, this case would stay with whomever investigates homicide cases in your jurisdiction. So they would work it as a possible homicide until they determined it wasn't. And when they determine it wasn't a homicide, they would still clear the case they would clear the case as a suicide or accidental death, but it would still be the homicide detectives that were working the case. And then one last vocab thing for this section is to make sure that you use the word decedent rather than the deceased or deceased. This is something I actually see quite often in police reports. Deceased is obviously a past tense verb, not a noun. So when you're referring to the body or to the person, it's the decedent. Thanks for the question, Jesse. Gold Shield patron CC Jameson of ccjameson.com asked about what would happen if a homicide detective received a threatening letter at their home. Are there set procedures to reporting it? Would the detective be allowed to investigate it, or would it automatically be handled by someone else? Assuming the detective's supervisor should be immediately notified, would it be plausible for the detective to choose not to do so? And if so, what potential problems could they get into? Well, there are procedures, protocols, and best practices for damn near everything nowadays. So yes, you are correct, CC, in the assumption that the threat should be reported to a supervisor ASAP, and that the detective would not handle their own case. But do not let these rules ruin a great story. Now, you will be juggling reality, or the rules, I guess, with artistic license. But I think the secret here is to be aware of that. I think you can create some pretty progressive complications in your story that make it seem plausible for your detective to delay revealing this to a supervisor. But they really couldn't realistically, I guess, delve into a full-on investigation into figuring out who left this threat, without it leading to bigger problems. Now, those potential problems go well beyond simply getting in trouble with the bosses. And this is why a real detective would not wait to report this and would want someone else to handle the investigation. If this is a legitimate threat and there is some sort of as of yet unidentifiable connection between this threat suspect and the detective, whatever the detective does will be under the microscope if and when this thing actually escalates to the point where it is presented to a jury. A good detective will be thinking like the suspect's defense attorney, even though they don't know who the suspect is. And by reporting it ASAP, as soon as possible, and not being part of the investigation side of things when it comes to the threat, it alleviates any kind of claim of this being a personal issue that the detective may have had some sort of hand in exacerbating. So you want it to still be as sterile or as true to the original situation as possible. So if you start looking into it yourself, you're going to kind of ruin that, especially if you end up confronting the suspect at some point. Now, if you add in a spouse or children, this elevates the concerns even more. I personally would want all the backup I can get when it comes to protecting my family, and this would not be the time to go all Lone Ranger on this. Besides, how effective would you really be with your regular work, your regular caseload, with this lingering constantly? In Cece's questions, she also asked, what if it wasn't a threat per se, but just something weird, like a strange or unexpected gift, like a box of flowers on the doorstep? What goes through a detective's mind? Especially if they've handled a few cases where they could see a connection between the gift and previous cases they've worked. Well, assuming there is no note or card with those flowers, which is why this would seem weird and unexpected, I assume, certainly would for me, I would, as I kind of talked about, or not kind of, I definitely talked about in the last episode, I would find myself immediately in condition orange. This gift, regardless of what it is sending the message, I know where you and your family live, which to me is a threat. It didn't come to my office and it didn't come with a note. Knowing that this is a message, I'd assume the person wants to know that I received it and may even be getting some sort of gratification from seeing that. So it's very likely the person was within line of sight of the gift, watching and waiting for my reaction. Now, I'd like to think I would play it calm and collected and call my supervisor right then, or maybe call 911. But realistically, knowing my own personality, not liking that role reversal of hunter to prey, I'd lock the front door behind me and start checking the street for anyone surveilling me. We worked a case once where a man would leave cutouts from porn magazines on women's car windshields, like when they would get out of the car and go into the grocery store. And I should add that he would write vulgar statements on these graphic images. But his fetish was in seeing the reactions of the women he targeted. So when they came out of the store and found this thing on their windshield, he liked seeing the shock and the fear. He liked the power he felt in that moment. Obviously, we caught the guy. So I guess that's kind of included in my mindset of why I would assume someone was watching the reaction of picking up that gift off the front doorstep. So would checking every car on my block without any kind of backup be the smartest move? Probably not, but it's honestly what my immediate reaction would be, to go back from prey back to predator instantly, as quickly as I could. It made me think of the line from Dexter, the TV show. So as Dexter Morgan once said, in the land of predators, a lion never fears a jackal. Thanks for the question, CC. You can find CC's work at ccjameson.com. Thank you so much for listening this week. Make sure you hit that subscribe button to get every episode of the Writers Detective Bureau automatically. Thank you so much for listening for 50 episodes. I can't believe we've hit this so quickly. So if you enjoyed the episode, would you leave me a review? That would be so awesome. And thank you so much for the recent reviews. I really appreciate those. It's quite flattering. So thank you for the positive reviews. That has been awesome. So just a reminder, this podcast is created for you, so do not be shy. Just like I said at the beginning, send me your crime fiction questions by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.